So as usual, the day goes by. We don't even realize it, even though it feels long. It also goes by very quickly with the quality of discussion that we have. And, you know, there was we were talking about investments and dividends in the last panel, and that was in reference to community innovations. But we're really, for this panel, and it's a different one than one we've usually had, is we're really going to look at literally investments and dividends and in the real world, so to speak, of finance. And it's something that a lot of you are aware of that's been going on both in New York and around the country, where the private sector has made a big play, as they would call it, in areas of criminal justice and social justice. We've got a great panel to discuss the area, this area which is increasingly becoming something of interest to journalists who write about it and to the community at large. So, so to lead us in this panel, we got all the panelists here. Is Liz Gaines here?
Liz is on her way.
Oh, well,
she's on her way.
I'll go get it. Or sure. Anne's going to go get it.
And you said 5:15 is
a 5:20. And the one thing is, I want to emphasize to you that after the panel, starting around 5:30, we're going to have a reception upstairs and a dinner, a special dinner where we'll announce the winners of our annual journalism awards and give an award to David Simon, the creator of The Wire. So a lot of you have tickets for it. Those of you who don't yet, I invite you to come upstairs. It's going to be a spectacular event. So please do join us upstairs. There will be student ambassadors and escorts, we call them ambassadors, to take you up there to the right place. So really, please come. If you have any questions about it, you can ask any of our staff. The dinner will start at around 6 o'clock and go till about 7:30 or 8 o'clock. All right, so to lead our panel, while Liz is on her way, we're really pleased to have Dean Starkman, former Wall Street Journal journalist, and now edits The Audit, which is the business desk of the Columbia Journalism Review, where he's the magazine's Kingsford Capital Fellow. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, a co-winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Investigations while he was in the Providence Journal. And he was at the Wall Street Journal for 8 years. When we first met him officially as a center a couple of years ago when we did an amazing conference on white-collar crime and criminality, which ended up as a book, which just came out this fall. And it was our first venture and look at this is entirely different today, of course, at the impact of corruption and fraud and white-collar fraud on the country's finances and crisis. So it's an area that we're going to continue going through, but Dean was one of the first to really sound the alarm that the media has not been talking about this and should have been talking about it. But we'll leave that discussion to another day. But Dean, take it away.
Okay. Great. Thank you all. Thanks all for being here. Everyone can hear me okay? Great. This should be an interesting panel, and I want to introduce our panelists because we actually have a good one, and we're going to be able to, they'll be able to each deal with different levels of this. Of this financing mechanism, social impact bonds. I was gonna subtitle this panel "Wall Street Goes to Prison," but I didn't think that was
from your lips.
Didn't quite. No. Just one. Had to have one Wall Street gag.
Bring it on.
All right. The way it's what we're gonna do is I'm gonna let me introduce the panelists, and you'll sort of see what they'll be able to offer to bring to this discussion, which is, you know, about the, I guess, efficacy and propriety and the reasonableness of applying a for-profit financing mechanism to social service problems and some of the most sensitive and difficult and knotty social service problems at that. And there's lots of sort of, you know, questions that I expect a lot of people in this room would have them. I encourage you to to ask them. I think we'll go through a few preliminary remarks from each of our panelists. Maybe we'll have some discussion up here, but I don't think anyone should feel overly inhibited about raising your hands or speaking up. Because there's a lot of enthusiasm about these things which we're about to learn about. We're going to assume most people don't know what a social impact bond is, as I didn't 10 days ago. But there seems to be a lot of growing enthusiasm about them in the social services network and maybe in some financing and philanthropic circles. And before we sort of rush headlong into this new thing, let's take a look at it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce our panelists in order of their appearance. So to my left, with sense of humor, is Alicia Glenn, head of the Urban Investment Group at Goldman Sachs. You'll see everyone has, this is quite an impressive panel. She's responsible for implementing the firm's Community Reinvestment Act business strategy. She joined Goldman in 2003, was named managing director in 2005. Prior to joining Goldman, she was assistant commissioner for housing finance at the New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development. She also serves on the boards of the Corporation for Supportive Housing, the Citizens Budget Commission, and the Bowery Residence Committee. She serves as a trustee of the Enterprise Community Partners, Inc., graduate of Amherst and Columbia Law. Liz is executive director of the Osborne Association. Under her leadership, over the last 29 years, the Osborne Association has grown from a two-person operation to one of the largest multi-service criminal justice organizations in the country, working in collaboration with New York State and City criminal justice, child welfare, and health agencies. Liz operates one of the country's most innovative and effective social agencies for incarcerated individuals, children, and families in the Bronx, Brooklyn, Poughkeepsie, and in 20 New York State prisons and Rikers Island, which we'll be talking about today. In addition to jail and prison-based services, Osborne offers alternatives to incarceration and reentry support. Liz began her legal career as a criminal defense lawyer in connection with the 1971 Attica prison rebellion and as a staff attorney at Prisoners Legal Services of New York. And Kimora, Professor Kimora is a professor here, which teaches courses in criminal justice and corrections to graduate and undergraduates. A self-described prison reformer, which is a good thing to describe yourself as. Kimora works as an educational consultant facilitator at the Osborne Association. She teaches parolees coping skills and how to overcome addictive behaviors. She received her PhD in education at the University of Minnesota in 1995, a master's from Wisconsin-Madison. With years of experience as a lobbyist, educational administrator, professor, public speaker, and writer, she's dedicated to, quote, she says, changing systems so that people can live in harmony. She lives with her husband, Sri John, who's a physician in New York. And so that's the order we're going to go, because I kind of feel like that would be sort of the macro financing picture and then the actual organization that runs the thing that is to be financed, and Kimora will help us with the actual substance of what happens, as Liz will too. So I guess I'm going to invite Alicia to start, and she's helpfully offered to actually do a PowerPoint, which I really welcome in this case, because we're sort of, I assume not everyone here is a bond expert, and we're not even sure these are bonds.
Okay, tell me how to do
that. And that'll be the first question.
They are most certainly not bonds, but Ann Banker can go nowhere without a PowerPoint. So let me do that. I think it might.
Right, so we know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think let me just say a couple of things if we can pull the presentation up. One, I think, you know, there's always the inevitable first question, which is, what on earth is Goldman Sachs doing in this line of work, period, end of discussion, which I think is a fair starting point. And so I thought I'd give a little bit of context as to how we think this relates to our broader work at Goldman and in the group. Oh, wow, so that was super fast.
It actually came through as a PDF.
Okay, so does that mean I can still put it, like, go to the next?
Okay. I can help you.
Thank you. Thank you for being, so next slide. Thank you. So just 2 minutes of context, because it is, I think a lot of people don't even understand that places like Goldman are in this business, but so the Urban Investment Group is a in-house business at Goldman that specifically for the past 10 or 11 years has used the firm's own capital to invest in urban communities, and particularly focused on underserved urban communities and trying to identify really all of the pieces of the puzzle that can really inhibit development and economic opportunity and growth for mostly, you know, our most vulnerable or most underserved communities and neighborhoods. And historically, much of that has been sort of thought of as community development financing, social impact financing, et cetera, all really thinking about how can the private sector inject capital into these communities in order to create double bottom line results. So that you're looking at what are the financial returns of your capital, but you're also always thinking about what are the less tangible, sort of from a financial metric point of view, but the real social impact of your work on the ground. And I'm sure we'll get into a conversation about what is social impact, but in some cases, I think it's fairly easy to measure. And so we do a lot of different things as part of that puzzle under the broader community development rubric. So we build affordable housing. We finance community facilities, whether those are healthcare facilities, schools, after schools program. We invest in neighborhood retail as part of a broader comprehensive strategy about what does this place need? You know, what are the component parts of a healthy neighborhood? We have spent a lot of time working on small and local business strategies and really trying to create those mechanisms. Again, it's part of a healthy community where people can work and see economic opportunity in their own communities. And we've recently been spending more and more time on the non-sort of bricks and sticks part of community development and social impact investing and really thinking about two pieces of that puzzle. One is access to financial services, which I won't spend a lot of time on, but talking about folks who are really underbanked or unbanked and how they can get mainstreamed so they can begin to access financial services. The classic example being, if you're a poor person and you go to a check casher, you pay $20 to cash a $100 check. If you're a rich person at Goldman Sachs, you don't pay anything to cash a check, right? So really thinking about some of the inequities that are intrinsic in the financial services system and how we can try to bring more people into the mainstream. And then that also led us to think a lot about what are the other chronic problems that are inhibiting a lot of these communities and the folks in communities from really being able to live really productive lives. And so that's where we began to think about the provision of social services and how we could inject some of our capital to address some of those most intractable problems, which, again, are layering on to all these other building blocks of what we're trying to do to create healthy neighborhoods. So, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. It's about $3 billion of our own capital we put to work, and there's a lot of statistics about all this stuff that we've done. But, again, it's really thinking about these problems and how can we balance an appropriate financial return with demonstrable impacts on the ground. Next slide. Well, again, this is sort of a similar thing, but, you know, again, it takes form in a lot of different ways. But I think the big takeaway is it's really all about public-private partnerships. None of this work is done purely by the private sector, and very little of it is really being done by the public sector in any real way anymore in terms of the ability to have the capital necessary to achieve these goals. And those create very interesting partnerships between the private sector, the public sector, and the nonprofit sector, who often play that sort of linking role between the two sides of the dumbbell, if you will. And so, again, we provide capital in a million different ways, but I think that's really the theme is how do we work with all of these different vital stakeholders to craft something that will work both for the public sector, for our return needs, and for the communities. So,
I'm going to play moderator. Sure. and tell everyone that we want the initial things to be about 10 minutes or less.
Okay.
So,
do you want me to go through the Rikers deal now?
Bond looks like, and then a little bit on the Rikers deal. And
perfect. Okay. So the first thing is there is no such thing as a social impact bond. It's social impact, not a bond. Please, if you do one thing today, bonds are securities that are traded on the open market and are rated by agencies, and people can buy, right? If you have a mutual fund, you can buy a muni bond. This is not a bond. It is really a loan, right? Generally, you make a loan against a piece of real estate or against some sort of cash flow, and that's exactly what this is. This is a loan made to somebody who are then going to use the proceeds of that loan to pay for a service, right? So instead of making a loan to a developer to build a building, we're making a loan to a non-for-profit organization so they can actually pay for the services. In a normal loan, we'll take a real estate loan, the way you get your money back is if that building is built and people pay their rent, there's a rent stream there and you pay back the loan. Here, we get our money back if the intervention, the services that are provided, result in certain predetermined impacts. In this case, a reduction in recidivism. At which point, if those numbers are achieved, we get our money back. The difference here is who do we get our money back from? We don't get it back from the nonprofit. We get it back from the city of New York. Because the city of New York has decided that it's incredibly important to find a way to have other people pay for these services, because they don't have any money to do it. They're shifting the risk onto us. But if it works, they are willing to pay back our loan because two things have happened. One, recidivism has actually reduced, and that's a good thing. And two, more important than it's a good thing in and of itself, the city is going to save a lot of money, right? Because every time they can shut down barracks, is that the right word?
Housing areas
on the island, it saves them X dollars, right? And so they go through that calculus in terms of the long-term savings. It is better to pay us to provide these services so they can save money in the long run. And that's really what a social impact bond or loan is. It's transferring the risk from the public sector, who would have to pay for these services, onto the private sector, who are willing to say, we believe this intervention will work. Do you agree to pay us X dollars if it does work? And then we get our money back, and the taxpayers have a double win. They didn't have to pay for the services up front, and they're going to have long-term cost savings if the impact actually are delivered. If it doesn't work, by the way, we don't get our money back. So it is shifting the risk onto the private sector. So, again, I can, and we'll just put the, maybe we'll leave it up there, the transaction slide, which is the next page.
Can you charge
interest? Yes. And the interest, the amount of interest we get depends on the amount of recidivism, reduction in recidivism that occurs. That is on a sliding scale. So I thought, and then I'll stop, but maybe put the transaction up, which may help people understand. It's the next slide. And then maybe we just leave that up there unless you guys have PowerPoints. That may be just, again,
helps
understand.
We don't.
And see where people fit in the puzzle.
I'm limiting PowerPoints to this one.
It's kind of hard, it's kind of hard to read, right?
Foggy or just...
That helps, right?
Yeah, because that'll place everybody, like, who the players are in this transaction, I think.
You might as well explain it for people who can't see.
Sorry.
Yeah, welcome.
Okay.
Maybe welcome
so
through
the
actual
works.
Rikers deal,
okay.
Right.
So, and then maybe move it up, if we make it larger, and then move it up so you don't have to see all the gold and blah, blah, blah on top.
Just dropped us off the
Yeah, it was good. Right?
Okay.
It needs to be a little larger.
You go.
No worries. You'll get it.
Wait. Luckily, this is a casual crew here, so.
All right.
That's good. Almost good enough. Good. Okay.
And sorry, what's the one below? Sorry, my fault.
God, if we could inch it up a little bit, but Joe, maybe you'll.
It's fine.
Okay. So how does it work? Goldman Sachs on the left makes a loan to a nonprofit, MDRC, who are the intermediary. That's who we're actually making the loan to. The intermediary then takes that money, in this case $9.6 million, and invests it with Osborne, gives it to Osborne for them to actually use the proceeds to provide the services, the intervention, to the inmates on Rikers. Okay? At the same time, the city of New York enters into a contract with MDRC, which says, if recidivism goes down X, Y, or Z, we will pay you money, MDRC.
What's MDRC?
Oh, that's just an acronym now.
It used to be Manpower Research, whatever. But
they literally have become
MDRC.
An acronym, right. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, they were Manpower mm-hmm. Research.
And by City of New York, do you mean the Bloomberg Foundation?
No. This, I mean, actually the City of New York. That is a registered contract for the City of New York to pay MDRC.
That's on the lower right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's through the Department of Corrections, but your counterparty is really the City of New York.
Okay. Right, don't. And explain where the Bloomberg Foundation comes in, because I think that's confusing. Sure. This got a,
This first one is a bit of a pilot program, or a model it is a pilot program, and it has a lot of...
We're making it up as we go along.
Yeah, and it has some philanthropic components to it. It's not like a strictly commercial deal.
Right. Well, it is, because in commercial deals, you also have credit enhancement. But yeah, so the city agrees to pay back the money to MDRC if they perform. Meanwhile, Vera, on the side over there, actually validates the data, right? So when you say, do they perform, there's a third party who's actually scrubbing the data, that there's no, you know, potential for lack of transparency around the results. The extra twist to this transaction is that the Bloomberg Foundation has agreed to essentially guarantee 75% of Goldman Sachs' loan as what we call credit enhancement, similar to like the 7A program, which is a small business program. The government guarantees 75% of every loan Citibank makes to a small business. Here, instead of it being the government, the Bloomberg Family Foundation is the guarantor in this transaction, because there is no federal guarantee for this, which is an interesting topic we can talk about. Right. So that if, in fact, the whole thing doesn't work, we can call on the guarantee to pay us $7.2 million of our original $9.6 million. So we could the most we could lose is $2.4
million. If it doesn't fall, you still get
75%
back?
If it all goes bad, we get 75% of our principal back.
But that's only through this particular guarantee on this.
This was a highly structured transaction just for this. Now, one of the good things about this, and then I promise I'll shut up, is that we don't expect that to happen, and the Bloomberg Foundation has already agreed that to the extent the guarantee is not called on, which we don't expect it to be called on, it can be used by MDRC to do more social impact loans in the future. So it can become almost like a revolving evergreen guarantee, which is terrific for potentially doing another one of these.
And this is only in the city of New York?
Five-year loan. This is just for Rikers, and the city of New York are paying the money back.
Great. Great. Now, these questions are fine, and just throw them out. So essentially...
we don't have to keep it up.
No, keep that up there.
Yeah, no, actually, it's helpful.
So that helps.
But, so this is... Basically, she's saying is we're Wall Street, and we're here to help. No, but it pays to be skeptical, and you know, there's some things here. But again, there's a lot of enthusiasm about this. But I have some questions, and I expect you guys do too. And Liz will talk about where she fits in her organization as well.
Right. So the intervention that was determined for this was a cognitive behavioral therapy for. At the adolescent jail, so these are detained adolescents. For those of you who are not from New York State, you may not know that in our state and North Carolina, 16 and 17-year-olds are in the adult system. So this is Rikers Island, our city jail, 16, 17, and 18-year-olds. And it's measuring the effectiveness of this particular cognitive behavioral intervention, which, when it was first announced at our first press conference, I was banned from using the expression cognitive behavioral therapy because they were afraid that the journalists would think it was too woo-woo and wouldn't understand. And I said, Weight Watchers, tell them Weight Watchers, they'll get it. And plus, cognitive behavioral therapy is what every middle-class parent who's ever had a kid with any kind of disorder is told to get. And we could sort of demystify that this is some weird sort of intervention, but nonetheless, because Osborne has both experience working at Rikers Island and extensive experience delivering cognitive behavioral interventions, we were very interested in doing this. The math had already been done. Someone had already figured out that based on existing evaluations of MRT, the particular intervention we're using, that recidivism should be able to be reduced by a certain percentage. And then the money mavens figured out that would, if you reduced it that much, that the cost to the Department of Correction for incarcerating juveniles would be reduced by a certain amount of dollars, meaning that if this whole thing works, they can pay back wherever the money comes from and still, in a sense, turn their own profit, but more so the idea would be that they would then be able to justify to taxpayers the continued funding of this intervention over time after the evaluation is done and after everything is done. So the cohort that we're going to be serving from this past January through December is going to be the studied group, and we're collecting lots of data, and Vera will compare the results. The grant is for 3 years, so they'll be following this first year. We'll continue to deliver the program in years 2 and 3 at the same funding level, but they're going to only evaluate the impact on this first year of kids that we're serving. It was actually through an RFP process in which I have to, I actually had no idea what the financing was when we applied to do this program. I just thought it was an extraordinary opportunity to be able to touch 3,000 detained adolescents on Rikers Island, and also assumed that we could do more than merely this one intervention. When it was sort of put out there, the goal wasn't just recidivism reduction. It was also to reduce violent incidents on Rikers Island, which to me was very important. And Osborne has delivered similar interventions in a lot of prisons, and I really believe that if you can get a critical mass of incarcerated individuals involved in something like this, you can actually change the culture of a jail. And part of the opportunity here is not just working with the young people, which we are with, I think, 100% of the ones not in punitive segregation, but also we're developing with the Youth Development Institute a pretty significant educational initiative for the correction officers, who will then have 1 to 2 weeks of training in youth development and understanding the program. And already we've seen some impact on incidents or alarms that on Rikers. The other thing that's been really beneficial about the way it's going is that DOC is unusually invested in the success. Some people were a little skeptical. They figured they only have to pay it back if it works, so maybe they would undermine it. And that's not, in fact, how they've approached it at all. This was largely the idea of the commissioner of DOC. She really believed there should be some kind of good programming for these kids. They should be in a juvenile justice system. So since they're not, let's try to do the kinds of things that you might actually consider doing in a system designed for 16 and 17-year-olds. So, for example, they've moved kids out of dorms into cells, which has been definitely reduced the nighttime alarms, increased a sense of safety, and now we're doing a whole bunch of developing other kinds of activities in the idle hours. So far we're working on yoga and drumming and other things that if they didn't want me to say cognitive behavioral therapy, I'm pretty sure they definitely don't want to go with Reiki yoga and drumming. But the kids love it.
Right.
I really want to have questions in a discussion, but that's generally what it is we're doing. We've hired facilitators, highly trained in doing this. It is worlds colliding. The complexity of this, I just try to ignore it because we have a lot of bosses and we have to meet on every month. Actually, Goldman has managed to slime out of those meetings somehow, but it includes Deputy Mayor Linda Gibbs's office and DOC and us and MDRC and MIC, KEY. But really very, problem-solving oriented. And I think there was something about feeling like there's this kind of money on the line and the evaluation that's made it happen. So just, as a totally full disclaimer, my first complete sentence is the worker is always right. The idea of having a capitalist approach to doing this was, not something that I immediately warmed up to. I believe in big government. I think it's government's job to provide interventions like this. However, our government isn't providing these interventions. And so the idea of trying some new way of financing this was attractive to us.
Great.
We're enjoying it.
I'm going to ask you a couple of quick things just before we get to Kimora. Just to overview, how many, you probably said so, but again, how many kids are?
3,000 a year for 3 years.
For 3 years.
We'll be intervening
right.
With 9,000 young people.
And the 9.6 million is
we don't actually
see all that, right?
We get $7.4 million
right.
over, I think, something like that, or $2.5 million a year. It's not enough, and it's a limited intervention. If somebody had involved us much earlier, I would have had a lot to say about why this intervention by itself, is the only thing we can do.
Right.
But we are, as I explained to them early on when they said, just do this, I said, I don't have people on my staff that are going to ignore a kid living in a car.
Right, right. Okay, good. And how many staff did you hire with this?
I think we have 22 facilitators.
22.
For 3,000.
Right.
The intervention requires a one facilitator per 7 kids as a requirement. So in order to do that, you need a lot of.
Got it. So in 3 years, right? Just again.
It's 10 weeks, though, right? It's a 10 week.
Well,
so you're not doing 3,000 kids at once.
Right.
No, you're not. There's about the population's about 500 on a given day. They're not all in school on a given day. It's in the school. Their average length of stay is actually 23 days because these are detainees. Some are there long enough to do the whole program,
right.
And the ones who aren't are supposed to come to come to the community to complete it. And then we subcontracted with another nonprofit that has more youth programming in the community.
I'm sorry, and the last thing is, when do you decide whether it's worked or not?
When do we decide?
When is it decided? Whether how long? What point? 3 years from now?
Well, if my staff hasn't all quit by December, I'm going to call it a complete success.
Right.
But
no, I mean whether or not Goldman gets paid.
Vera is collecting all the data over this year, and
right.
I believe 2 years later they will, because they're going to follow the kids that are in this year for 2 years.
Right. Got it.
So 3 years from now, I'll come back and let you know.
And that's when the contract would be.
No, actually, we don't, our term is 5 years, but in 3 years we'll have our first data set.
Good. Great.
And what's the reduction in recidivism?
They want...
What's the percentage?
20% is our 20%. Goal, but I believe that then there's a sliding scale for what the payoff is, anywhere between 20 and 10%.
10 is the sort of... 10 is the base case, the bottom. So at 10%,
so
we get our
10,
money back.
There's no payoff.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
Right.
You fall off a cliff, which is also sort of a funky structuring thing, which you wouldn't normally do.
Right.
47%.
And I guess it'll be measured against a control group that someone will...
Recidivism being defined as going back to jail, not an arrest.
Within one...
Within
1 year?
2 years?
2 years.
And it's days in jail. Is that apples and apples, 47 to 10?
No,
it's 10% of the 47.
Of the 47.
Okay,
it has to be enough that they can close an entire housing unit because reducing smaller amounts is marginal cost that doesn't save $10 million or whatever they're going for here.
So,
and I guess if when you said 10%, it's a difference of 10% between the control group and the
10%
There's not a control group. That there was supposed to be a control group.
My bad.
And DOC couldn't control the control group. People, kids kept just going into whatever classroom. If you've ever been on Rikers Island, this will come as no big surprise to you, but they literally could not separate the groups in a reasonable way. So Vera redesigned it to compare this year's cohort to two previous years that they're going to have to match it up against.
And so the recidivism rate is 10 percentage points lower than it used to be.
Then that will be a
good
success.
All right, great.
Mm-hmm. I'm going for 20.
Right.
Good.
Kimora, maybe
because I want Goldman to get every single
absolutely.
Dime.
That's right.
As do we all. Question here before we go to Kimora.
Could you break down what the interest is depending on the rate of the drop?
I bet that's Alicia could help with that or her.
It actually doesn't. The way the note is structured, it's not actually based on actual interest. What we did was we have a schedule of if 11%. This is all transparent. It was in the press release. It sort of steps down, right? So at 10%, we get our $9.6 million. At 13%, we get $10,368,000. I mean, it's really de minimis interest. And what we did do, which is unusual, and I don't think would be where the market is going to go, is we capped our maximum payment at $11.7 million against the $9.6 million, and that's at a 20%. So every dollar above that, the city gets all the savings, right? Which is also, again, I doubt where the market is going to go ultimately if these things become more commonplace. So every dime above that amount that we're taking at the 20% goes to the city. So it's not truly, I mean, it's not the way a typical instrument would not work that way.
20% meaning 20% reduced.
Yeah, so then if it's 25% reduced, they save all that extra money. We don't get a piece of that savings.
Great. We good on the basic outline? Good. Kumar could talk as a practitioner and about how you see all this.
Thank you. And good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be here. And I want to thank the Center for on Media, Crime, and Justice and Mr. Starkman for having us and Steve Handelman for having us this afternoon. Why is cognitive skills education so important and part of all of this? Well, if you look at the sheet that I've handed out, I think most of you have it, we really need to understand that cognitive skills education is really an important part of education that actually can reach those who have been in prison or in jail. I will not, by the way, refer to them as inmates. We call them participants, so out of respect for them. But if you look at cognitive skills research, you can look at many different aspects, but there's some basic components to it that actually much of the American public really doesn't understand very well in terms of their own behavior during their lifetime. For example, problem-solving skills are crucial, and people who have been serving some time in prison or jail who have been arrested have, in many cases, very little understanding between the difference between a problem and a solution. So this is crucial for them to learn. Second part of cognitive skills oftentimes is what we call social skills. And these people are out to lunch when it comes to that, not figuratively or whatever, but the point is that they don't know how to function when somebody gets upset with them. They think that, you know, perhaps I'm just going to start a fight if I can't get what I want. So we can teach them how to actually solve a problem in a civil manner in a social setting. Another third aspect of cognitive skills education that's universally used throughout the world is just the dealing with the fact that people get angry. So how do you deal with anger management? How do you get somebody to calm down? How do you recognize what causes anger for a person? Many people in this country are chronically depressed. They don't even understand that anger is at the core of depression. So this is a very complicated issue, particularly when you're dealing with people who have been abused, traumatized in life. Fourth kind of basic kind of cognitive skills education is creativity. Many people do not recognize that they are extremely creative. So if you take a program like moral recognition therapy, which is used, which is also called MRT, one of the first things that's asked of the participant is to map out what was going on in their life a year ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago that put them where they're at. And also, what could have happened a year ago, 5 years ago, or 10 years ago that could have put them on a different path where they were not causing harm to themselves and others. And a fifth aspect, and what I consider one of the most important, crucial parts of cognitive skills education, is critical thinking. And critical thinking, as you may know, does not mean we're going to be negative about something, but we're actually going to teach people how to be leaders. The Foundation for Critical Thinking, for example, has amazing work that basically deciphers three different categories of critical thinkers in this country and in the world. One are those that are completely uncritical, the uncritical person, who basically is not interested in learning anything or does not know the importance of learning. So therefore, even though they're very naive and they kind of walk through life like that, they have good hearts, but they're easily deceived and manipulated and indoctrinated by a second category of people called self-serving critical thinkers. And those people know just a little bit more than somebody else about something, so they know how to pull the wool over somebody and cause problems. Third kind of critical thinker is the fair-minded critical thinker. This is what we want the participants to be. We want the participants to love learning, to be open-minded, to be logical, to be honest about what's going on in their life so they want to change, and to treat themselves and others with respect. That is the goal, in our minds, of cognitive skills education. Now, if you look at the I'm not going to cite the study per se because I don't want to embarrass anybody in this room, but I want to point out to you just briefly why critical thinking skills is such an important part of cognitive skills. It's something that we emphasize quite a bit. About 5 years ago, there was a study done in a series of high schools in one state in this country that we'll keep anonymous. And the question was asked of every single high school teacher, do you think that all of your students need to learn critical thinking skills? And virtually every single teacher said what, do you think? Yes or no?
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. Second question, what are critical thinking skills? Do you know that 98% of those high school teachers did not know the answer to that question? So what this proves, among many things, is that it's really important for people to understand that cognitive skills is really important, critical thinking is very important. Critical thinking is so important if we are to understand that many of the people that have served time or have been detained are actually leaders. They are born leaders. You can debate that all you want. I've seen enough of it during the 23 years of work that I've done as an educator in prisons and jails to know that much of the leadership of the planet is there, needs to be developed. It is vital. In 2008, the Pew Institute came out with an interesting study, and it was mentioned in the February 28th issue of the New York Times. The article was called, 1 in 100 U.S. Adults Are Behind Bars. There's no excuse, as far as we're concerned in this country, for people to not be educated. It is vital that people learn these basic forms of cognitive skills that I've just outlined. If you look at the sheet that I handed out to you at the bottom, I list several different types of cognitive skills training programs that I have worked with. I'll briefly tell you about them. Number one is Reasoning and Rehabilitation. It's a program from the Correctional Service of Canada, authored by Porporino. You can email me later if you have more questions about that. It's wonderful. And some of the cultural differences don't fit what we're doing here in this country, but it's amazing work. It's groundbreaking work in cognitive skills. Number two is Going Out by Going In, GOGI program. That was actually written by people who are incarcerated, male participants at the time, and Mara Lee Taylor picked it up, wrote a series of three books in that area, and she uses it extensively in prisons and jails in Utah and California. And it is absolutely amazing to see the self-esteem in the people changing. And as a result, when these people are in the pods, the corrections officers say, wow, my day is easy. I don't have to deal with nearly as many problems because people are doing the things we've been talking about. Third is Breaking Barriers. Breaking Barriers was written by a gentleman named Gordon Graham, who I personally know, who was incarcerated for over two decades in a prison in Washington and other areas. Finally, he realized, you know what? I need to change the way I'm doing something here. This is not working for me. I'm going to write about what I know other people need to know, and it is used by the Osborne Association. I've used it for about 8 years now with clients in the Bronx. The last one is Moral Recognition Therapy, MRT, which is the program that Liz Gaines was just mentioning, and it's part of the specific program that we're using at Rikers.
Great. Fantastic. I have questions occurred to me, so I'm going to ask one of each of the panelists, actually in the same order, but again, we're all friends here. Feel free to speak up. But one thing that did occur to me, almost the first thing I thought about when I heard about this is, okay, the things that Kimora were talking about are, you know, I'm going to take her at her word. I assume they're extremely valuable. Question is, what do we need this layer of complexity and expense that comes from this particular financing mechanism. So the question is, why can't the state itself or the city assess the risks, make the same kind of evaluations that Goldman here does, or any other potential investor in the social impact loan, I guess we'll call them. Why is it that the private sector would be better at this than the state, given that the state could do it a lot more simply and a lot more cheaply? See what I'm saying?
Is that for me?
Yeah, please.
Well, I don't think that's... Well, I sort of wish that Linda Gibbs or somebody from the city were here, because I don't think that... Not that we can do it better than they can. That's not even the issue. The issue is they're not doing it. They don't have any extra money to spend on programs that they believe are important programs and services to provide to their citizens. They make the choice, right? The Department of Corrections and the administration made the choice that this particular intervention was going to have the results that they were seeking as a public policy matter, correctly wanting to do everything they possibly could to reduce the rate of recidivism for all the right reasons, in addition to the cost savings, and that at the end of the day, if you've noticed, it's not like city budgets have been going up. City
right.
budgets have been going down. So if you are the budget director of a city and you don't have a lot of money to come up with programs that, by the way, are discretionary, not entitlement programs, you are trying to be a creative person and figure out how you can identify other sources. And that could be philanthropy, or in this case, taking it to the next level and saying, are there private sector solutions which we can harness in order to deliver the services that we want to, but unless we raise taxes, we're not going to be able to do it.
Right.
So I can't do it better. I just have the money, and they don't.
Got it. And is it literally true that there's no, like, capital budget for this kind of thing? And
well, it wouldn't be capital. It'd be operating. And, no, the operating budget of the city of New York is going down every year.
Right.
And in terms of the choices that the mayor makes and the council make, this would obviously be something they chose not to fund, and so they had to come up with other ways to fund them.
Right, and it literally wouldn't be a capital expense because
capital is capital, like building a building.
This is
operating.
I see.
Annual revenue, you'd have to appropriate it, so it'd be a choice of, are you going to fund an after-school program, or are you going to fund cognitive behavioral therapy? And they chose to do any sort of trade-off.
Right.
And they got pretty smart, I think, and pretty lucky to identify a set of people who were willing to figure out how to use private capital to pay for this public good.
Got it. And sure, go ahead.
Sorry.
All right, I was going to ask Liz, another sort of thing that occurs to me as a problem or disincentive to this, I'm looking for problems in a sense, just to make sure we're looking at this all the way around, is this, if these are ultimately to be, you know, become normalized and part of, and actually there's becomes a market for this, and rather than this program, you can kind of tell has lots of it's sort of a show program and has lots of sort of belts and suspenders and things that may not be present. The investor is going to be looking for the safest of the safe, right? They want the thing that's going to pay, and the thing that bothers me about this is if the cognitive behavioral therapy is so good, it's almost like a shame that that you're almost transferring not the risk but the benefit of something so safe and so effective from the state, which could get the benefit. See what I'm saying? And to the market. If you catch
my meaning. First of all, it's not that safe. I mean, it's been evaluated. It has not been used, as far as I can tell, at this scale, with this particular population, and smashed into such a very short time frame. So it's really scaling things that are proven, so that there's an uncertainty about it. I mean, I certainly am a little bit nervous. But where I kind of agree is that it's not probably the right mechanism for funding innovation, and I don't know how you do that. I mean, in a traditional venture capitalist is going to invest, like say if you're going to invest $1 million, you'll put $200,000 into five different things, and you'll figure three of them will fail, and one of them will break even, and one of them is just going to be a takeoff success, and that's how you're going to make your money back. That's how venture capital works. And social venture capital, someday I hope, would work similarly, where people will take those kinds of risks with something that's a good idea that maybe has not been completely evaluated, but where the what they now call the contrafactual information, meaning the data that shows how much you would save, either in human cost or in economic cost,
right?
And then do that. So, you know, I happen to be one of those people that believes that it's the government's job to protect our streets and our borders, but they're not. And I think that was sort of their point, is that they're not investing in these kinds of programs. The fact that they told me don't say cognitive skills should tell you that they were concerned that the public would think that this was being too nice. And this is our problem, is, you know, we're not, we serve difficult folks who are not popular. This is part of, I guess, Bloomberg's idea about young men of color and trying to provide services in a world in which that's not so popular. So if somebody else takes the risk, and obviously somebody thinks that that's going to happen because the governor just put $100 million into the proposed budget for next year to support what they call pay-for-success intervention. So it does require a government partner. It's just that they're saying, I don't think the taxpayers are quite ready for this, and it has to be somewhere in between the, it's kind of risky, it's too risky for the taxpayers, but it's safe enough for Goldman.
Right.
It's pretty ironic.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to go to questions. I actually had one. All right. I'm not going to ask it because that's the kind of guy, that's the kind of moderator I am.
Don't forget your questions.
Okay, well, I'm going to just kind of go
real short.
I'm going to go to whoever has the microphone. And I have I do have something I want to ask tomorrow.
Okay,
go ahead.
Ernie Drucker from John Jay. You don't have a control group, but you do have what we call in research usual care. So what happened before you instituted this program? So are you in a position to say what was going on with those kids in these same respects, how they spent their time, or how much time they spent in anything called therapy or in anything called school? That would be what's been happening before this intervention happened.
Vera believes that that they can do the right kind of matching to account for a number of things. That's not the only thing they're going to have to account for. They have to account for changes in arrest policy. If we suddenly stop, and frisk.
Do they use the word propensity scores?
I actually, you know, it's an independent evaluation. What that seems to mean is that Vera doesn't talk to me about it. You'll have to ask Goldman. We're just filling out forms.
You explain.
And interacting with the kids, doing the hard stuff.
And our understanding is that they weren't doing anything but what was legally mandated in terms of kids attending school.
Could you use a microphone because this is being recorded?
We'll get you a mic next time you talk.
Yeah. You could use a microphone.
While I have the floor, I'm going to do one clarification on the point.
But you have to take it into, say it only if you say it into the mic.
Use a mic.
Someone stole it.
There it is.
Someone stole
it. I'm Andy Phillips, also from Goldman Sachs, and spent the greater part of the last 6 months working on this. A clarification on the point that was made in terms of why wouldn't the city just do this on their own and reap all of the benefit. If Osborne hits their goal of a 20% reduction in recidivism, net of paying Goldman back $11.7 million, the city will have saved $20 million. So that's to give you a sense of why this is still very, very good for the city.
Thank you.
Mick Dumke from Chicago. What's in this for Goldman or for some other investment bank? Is this goodwill? Is this PR? Or do you actually think there's a potential to make money out of these kinds of arrangements?
Great question. I was going to add one thing to that. Is this part of actual Goldman's regular income statement? Is it actually part of the bank? Right. It's not part of a philanthropic arm or anything like that.
The answer to that question, I think, is yes, yes, yes. I think it's mostly driven by it. That's why I started with what our business is, because it's sort of counterintuitive that you would think that Wall Street banks are out investing in urban communities in general. But it's absolutely not in the philanthropic part of Goldman. It's in our bank. And again, in our view, it is absolutely the next natural step of any typical community development practice that is historically focused on, again, the built environment, which is solving one part of what are complex issues around why neighborhoods continue to struggle and why low and moderate income communities continue to struggle. To the extent that we can create financial instruments that allow us to deploy capital to work on these issues and get a fair return, a similar return to what we would get in any other type of community development investing, that is, to us, the natural evolution of what people are now calling basically social impact investing. So at the end of the day,
The returns we get, whether we're building affordable housing or financing a public health care clinic or a local small business, we are looking to add that, you know, to our toolkit. And yes, does it enhance the brand? I don't know. You tell me. I mean, is Goldman Sachs polling well? I don't think so. But I think that we, you know, I think that part of our challenge is to be thought leaders in using what are some pretty smart people who work with me to figure out how to develop these mechanisms that effectively allow the private sector to put their capital at risk to advance really important public policy agendas. And then it's up to the OMB directors to decide whether or not the city is going to save enough money in the long run, right? I'm not counting the beans at New York City. The budget director decided, wow, I'm willing to pay Goldman Sachs up front and some modest return because at the end of the day, we're going to save a lot more money, right? It's that discussion around what the cost savings are. So, you know, to the extent that people here in this room think we're better by doing this, that's fine, but that's not what most people are going to think about at Goldman Sachs, but it is part of a broader, I think, legitimate effort by really smart people on Wall Street to bring what we have to bear, both our actual capital, which we have a lot more of than a lot of struggling jurisdictions, and our human capital of knowing how to structure these deals, which I think, as Liz pointed out, does perhaps lend a, although it can be quite cumbersome at times, a focus on measuring the results and really trying to determine whether or not these impacts are coming so that at the end of the day, maybe the public sector can make better arguments about why taxpayers should pay for this. But right now, she's not allowed at a, you know, at a press conference to use the word therapy. We have a lot of work to do, right? And we were willing to get all groovy with therapy. We've all been in therapy. especially if you work on sex. So I think it's an important piece of the puzzle of bringing private capital, you know, to address these challenges.
I just want to add that you may notice in your program we originally were going to have another panelist here, Navjeet Bal from Nixon Peabody up in Boston, who would have given us another dimension about how this is working in others. So we don't want to just focus on Goldman as the only example of how this works, but Navjeet Bal in Boston is doing similar programs in New England and in Ohio, which are getting the support of the DOJ, the Department of Justice. So it has gone already wider than just the city of New York.
It started in England. The whole thing started in England.
Yep.
Right.
So to the point that Steve just made, I'm Ann Jacobs. I'm the director of the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay College. And on February 28th, we're hosting John Roman to speak more about social impact bonds. He's responsible for the BJA-funded project to create a blueprint for implementation of SIBs in America. So I hope those of you who are particularly interested in this will join us on the 28th in the morning. I have two quick questions. I think they're quick. One is, I don't get from the discussion today why an intermediary or what the role is there, except presumably there are costs associated with having an intermediary. So I'd like for someone to explain that. And then the second thing is more of a concern that having had experience with trying to evaluate new interventions, it seems to me to be particularly problematic to try to assess something based on the performance done in the first year. When people are just figuring out what they're doing, you're just staffing up, training staff. I would be very concerned about measuring something based on that.
So two questions. The one about the intermediary, that wasn't addressed when she was saying that the cities don't have the money and that's why.
The MDRC
role. Ah, right. That's a good question. Right. I mean, yeah, it's just another thing. Maybe it's peculiar to this particular program or maybe it's something that all of them need. I don't know.
It does seem to be common in the discussion. There aren't so many out there for us to be able to say. I'm using this as an excuse to go to Peterborough, England, so I can see the only other one. I think that when the state and the city both have issued these RFIs around the subject, they have thought of the intermediary as a critical component. I'm not sure I do, but as the people that handle the complexity of those relationships and do the design and the idea for the program, and then our job or whoever is selected to actually do the work is focusing on doing the work. And it may be based on the fact that I really know a lot about creating programs, and I know pretty much nothing about
managing
financing, and a lot of what MDRC has done did was contracting, and the complexity of that, which just ended up, I just at the end, I didn't have a lot to do. And that seems to be a common model, but in the state, when they issued their request for interest, they did say that you could propose being both the service provider and the intermediary if you're the kind of organization that would have both those skills. The intermediary is supposed to be, however, the entity that raises the money, that goes around to the Goldmans and the other potential investors, which, I mean, in retrospect, I guess I could have done, or another service provider could have done. And honestly, the next time I do this, I would want both roles, because we are a little bit stuck with a model that was designed by people that have never done what we do. And we are spending quite a bit of time trying to work around the edges to make it more doable. And sort of the second part of that is, it is hard to do at the beginning, but this is, they're not measuring in month one. We actually started this last May. And it, at the time, people seemed to think that by January we would be, which is when we just started the evaluation, that we would be sufficiently up and running for it to be measurable. Actually, turns out you're right, and it is probably for us a little bit scary that we are still dealing with what can the incentives be and how much can the correction officers come in and pull kids out of the class and training. I mean, I believe in this intervention, but you need very experienced facilitators, and quite honestly, the amount that we can pay just is not getting us people with or already experienced. So we are training several John Jay graduates to become good facilitators, and I would have preferred to have another 6 months to work out a lot of the kinks. I do think that people that are not practitioners doing jail and prison work on the ground don't actually appreciate some of the challenges. But, you know, we'll kill ourselves and make it work.
Over there, and then you.
Fascinating program. Two questions. Let's say it does work and you cycle out and the program ends. What happens next? Because if you don't keep doing this intervention, you'll have recidivism go up, right? And secondly, this is for juveniles in prison or in lockup. Where else could this similar model work? For example, in my community, if we had the money to invest in being sure that four-year-olds got every wraparound service they needed, we would reduce our crime and police and everything else. We know that. Would it work there?
No. No, because it would take too long. If your measurement in that case is crime, then no, because nobody's going to invest and wait 12 years to see whether they went to jail. On the other hand, I believe you guys told me about some idea people had about an intervention for four-year-olds where the measurement is something like fewer kids going into special education. For this to make sense, the alternative scenario, the contrafactual information, has to be costly. That's why people think jail, because the more it involves beds, the more expensive the alternative is. So if you're avoiding further incarceration, avoiding foster care placements, avoiding homelessness, those are all outcomes that can be measured as having a particular cost, but you'd have to be able to have an intervention that occurs where the outcome happens soon enough that people that are going to lend money or do this for 3 to 5, you can jump in any time, would want to see some outcome. So it's not that it wouldn't be good to do something for four-year-olds, but it would have to be something somewhat different where what you were seeing could be measured.
Well, right, but I think you raised the point, which is also, then it's really shifting that problem onto the public sector for them to say, we are willing to pay back you, the investor, based on a series of impacts that may not be so easy to measure in a short period of time. I think that this is where the field may be going, because a lot of what you say is absolutely true, and you intuitively know that if you provide those kids with more and more early on, it is less likely that when they're 18, they're going to be going to jail. But you can't, there's no causal link that the bean counter at OMB is going to be able to turn to. And so I think at some point, the public sector finance directors are going to have to get comfortable with saying, notwithstanding the fact that I don't know exactly how much money I'm going to save, I'm still willing to pay a private investor 10% a year because I'm going to wind up, I just know, saving 50%. And that, I think, is where this will evolve over time. But right now, we're at a place where we need a point in time where we can just say, this is what the data was. And the OMB guy can say, this is how much money I've saved, and I'm willing to share some of that savings with the private sector.
The first part of your question, though, was what happens at the end. So it's a little bit of a gamble because the current mayor and the current Department of Correction Commissioner is very clear that if we are showing some good results at the end of 3 years, they will use those savings to continue to fund us or someone that can beat us in an RFP process. To continue it, because those savings, I mean, it's not like they're going to bank them, but once it becomes part of it, which is why, by the way, one of the challenges we have is we would like to enrich this program. We don't think that MRT by itself is sufficient, but there's a concern that if we add a lot of bells and whistles, even if we raise the money ourselves, then the cost of the program as a totality will exceed the amount that they've said is the amount that they need to save. So we're kind of working on that. And that's the reason I love MDRC, and I don't mean that you shouldn't have intermediaries, but that's the part of the reason why it's important to know at the very beginning that you've priced it right. And actually, I think that with all the best intentions, it was actually priced a little low. And I'm perfectly willing to go out and raise more money, but I can't screw up the...
Right. Question here. Good way you want.
Hi, Rodney Benson, adjunct professor at Queens College. I retired from the New York City Department of Correction after 30 years. I just want to give you a perspective. During the 70s, the department was under a court order consent decree where those programs were mandated and funded by the city. Judge Lasker had to sign off on every program. And eventually, when Congress got involved, the city found a way to get out from under those consent decrees, which is leading to what you're now talking about, of having these programs privately funded, because everybody's saying, why are you spending money on people incarcerated and these schools are shutting down? So the city was funding these programs in the 70s up until about the mid-90s when it got out of those consent decrees and private capital took over.
Perspective. Are we...
That was a statement.
And a good one.
Brendan Kirby.
Helpful perspective, actually.
Brendan Kirby, AL.com, and from Mobile. I'm intrigued by this. I was wondering, you sort of talked about this a little bit, but how many times has this model been tried elsewhere, and kind of how far back does that go? And secondly, how does Goldman Sachs evaluate this particular program as a good risk or not? And would it still be an acceptable risk if you didn't have that 75% guarantee from the Bloomberg Foundation and you were exposing all the money?
Right. And I don't – this is – as far as I know, this is not a – this is a fairly new idea, and it was started not long ago in the U.K. in the Peterborough prison where a social service group made this proposal that if we reduce people from being reincarcerated by a certain percentage, would you pay us a certain return? And you know, they haven't. I believe it's so new that they haven't even they don't have measurable results yet. Although signs are good.
I got a question here.
But the question was for Alicia. Right.
How Goldman Sachs.
Sure.
Evaluates this as
a risk. I would add one thing. I mean, first of all, the Peterborough thing, it's true there are no results yet that I'm aware of, but I think the big game changer here is that was all done by philanthropic capital. So, again, it will have limitations on its applicability and its scalability, because there's only so much philanthropy that is going to go into this period. So those folks are not really looking for a return in the classic sense. If they lose their money, that would be bad for them, because they'd like to reinvest it, but it is a philanthropic effort. So this is the first time any private financial institution has ever invested in what people, again, are calling social impact bonds. So that's point A. Point B is, in terms of evaluating the risk, I think that it would be very fair to say that this was, you know, debated fiercely throughout the firm about just how risky an investment this is. I think Liz put it well, which is, look, there's a lot of data. All of that data was rolled up into a meta-analysis. We read all of that. Each time this has been used, it's been used in particular circumstances, and at some level you gain comfort from the fact that if you roll it all up, it looks like it should work, and that 20% is like a reasonable number. But again, the circumstances of any applicability are really important to understand, and New York is the biggest time anybody's ever tried to use this. So it is incredibly risky. If you're a risk manager, you would think this is pretty crazy. And there were a lot of folks at the firm who thought, wow, this is really risky and interesting stuff. And so we were, I think, had a fair amount of comfort that when we looked at the underwriting, if the base case was 20% recidivism, if you look across the meta-analysis, we needed to get 10% in order to get our money back. So we built in a fairly healthy cushion because nobody had ever done this on Rikers with this particular population. And anybody in our job would be crazy not to do that, right? If you think about any sort of first mover in an investment space. So we did build in a cushion. Vis-a-vis the guarantee, again, nobody does a deal thinking they're going to call in a guarantee, right? That's not how the world works. Again, I use a small business lending sort of arena as a classic example. Commercial banks don't make loans to small businesses who go out, as we know, 50% of small businesses fail within 5 years. They make those loans because the federal government provides a 75 to 80% guarantee on those loans. And so that has enabled a huge amount of capital to finance small businesses. Right now, the Bloomberg Philanthropies was interested in trying to create a marketplace for private investors to do this kind of work and was willing to do what the federal government has done in the small business space or in the multifamily housing space. Over time, as these things begin to be proof of concept and they work, in theory, you'd need less and less guarantee, right? Because you have enough results that other bankers can underwrite this and say, huh, it actually worked. We'll do this with less guarantee, right? So a market will evolve, but this is not uncommon, right, when you have private capital being used to achieve public ends.
I think this is probably going to be...
Yeah, we've got one question in the back.
Sure, maybe two more, and then I think we got to...
Mona Manga from Local Initiative Support Corporation. I'm just wondering... What the RFP process, was that managed by Goldman or by the city as far as who gets selected? And also, is there any thought into the Goldman Foundation kind of being the guarantor of the Goldman loans, similar to how the Bloomberg Foundation played that role?
Well, I don't know the second part. But the first part is it was wasn't a traditional RFP. It was managed by MDRC. That was who we applied to. And it was a RF something or other in which there were only, I think, six or seven organizations that were invited to apply. So you had to be, they pre-qualified organizations that had experience in either serving this population, working in a jail, and or delivering this intervention. And we had all three, but and there were a couple of our colleagues that did not even apply, even though they had the opportunity to, because they're smarter than I. No, they were. They had a real concern that the intervention didn't include post-release services, and they were not confident that they would be able to do that piece of it. Osborne has a somewhat of a different level of arrogance than a lot of others, and it's like, oh, how hard could that be? But MDRC made the decision. I assume they consulted with the funders, but I was not part of that, nor was it very clear from the RFP, whatever it was called, It did say something about unique financing, but it did not mention Bloomberg. It did not mention Goldman. It did not mention anything like social impact bond.
Great. I think last one, but I'm going to leave you to choose. Sorry.
We have one more. Is there a journalist? Yeah. Journalist in the House.
Journalist in
the House. Hi. Corinne Lesh with the New York Daily News.
Hey.
So are all of these youth scheduled to leave Rikers in 3 years or less? And are they nonviolent offenders?
I hope not. That would be a waste of our time. To work only with nonviolent folks. About over 80%, these are detainees. Their average length of stay is 23 days. That means it's pre-trial. And they will go from there. Either they'll go to state prison, which is about 15% of them will actually be sentenced to state time. 80% of them will be, at least 80% of them will be released. Another small proportion of them will get city time, meaning they'll be sentenced on a misdemeanor or less than 1 year, and they will serve some additional time on Rikers Island. There's a lot of them. The way it works is there's a whole bunch of them that are going to be released within 3 days, and we don't even try for them. The ones that, once you stay past a week, you're probably going to stay more like 40, closer to 4 months or so, which would be the ideal population. We are not particularly focused on their crime because whether they are personally violent or whether they personally have experienced trauma or they have personally need this intervention is generally fairly unrelated to what they were arrested for.
I just want to make a, just if I can, since we're talking about the press, and one of the takeaways we're interested in this conference is what the press can get for the different issues that we're talking about. I mean, you mentioned, Liz, and particularly you, that you're several times that you were afraid of how the press was going to relate or react to certain things, you know, therapy, yoga, drumming. But, I mean, that's an issue about, I mean, you got this sense that you can't say too much about the project because, hey, the press is going to dump on us. So how does the press get into that? I mean, are you guys transparent enough so that we can come to you and say, what's going on? Is this
working? We've actually had a really, our best experience with the Department of Correction around press, because I know a lot of journalists complain that they can't get into jail and into prison as much as they'd like to. And we've been very lucky because we're in so many prisons and have such a good relationship with the Department of Correction. And the Department of Correction is very enthusiastic about this. There have been actually quite a lot of journalists who've been able to come to Rikers Island. We don't like to see them in the classroom with the kids because that's about the privacy of the kids. But we've been able to arrange to have them meet with one or two, either in or out, and talk to our facilitators. I don't know, we just had a really nice thing in the Daily News about the fact that the governor is giving us a closed prison to remodel and turn into a reentry center. And we try to actually, I mean, if I were a journalist now in criminal justice, I would be studying neuroscience, because that's what cognitive skills is really about, and it is about what we're learning about, particularly the adolescent brain and how trauma is affecting these kids. And I heard it in earlier panels, these folks from Detroit and Dean Trulier talking about what it takes to work with young people. And I would love to engage more with journalists who are willing to drill down a little bit to think about how adolescents and how the rest of us, what we're learning about trauma and cortisol and our brains and things like that, I think will be very exciting. It was not me that was worried about so much about the press. I actually found more interesting, the challenges I got was, well, like, why are we doing this? Like, we get paid either way. We don't profit from success. And it was really interesting to me the number of press inquiries I got were like, well, why would we do this if we're not going to make money at it? And I'm going, I realized it was sort of more the financial press that was asking those questions. The more traditional were not. But I think that having people come and see the programs and learn the stories. But again, we've always been very, and this is not just me, any of the nonprofits, we do get a lot of these journalists calling and asking about, you know, we'd like to interview someone who married their mother and was violent and, you know, had ate their children and, you know, and can you set up an interview for me? And we'd like to follow them for 3 years. And, you know, so some of it is, you know, we have been
sounds
a little
right.
Burned on occasion.
I think I made that call.
I wouldn't mind doing that story. Anyway, we've only just scraped the surface, but at least we've started a discussion, we hope, on this really new area of private sector involvement and social impact. I guess we'll call them loans now rather than bonds.
But right.
Please join me in thanking our panel for getting us there. And Dean, for starting the ball rolling. Now,